When I was in divinity school, my preaching professor told us some things we should not do when giving a sermon. And these weren't so much cautionary words as they were an admonition. These were bad things. So we weren't to be the kind of preachers who would read the text out to you and say, this is what the text says, but I'm actually going to interpret it to say the complete opposite of what you just heard. We weren't supposed to read the text and then say, now that you've heard that, I'm going to go off and preach on something completely unrelated. We were supposed to avoid the airline problem where you're coming in for the landing at the end of the sermon, and then rather than touch ground, you decide to take off again and preach a second sermon. I think I've been pretty good about following these rules over the years I've been your pastor. But I have to confess, when confronted with today's passage from Luke, I was very tempted to just go off and preach something else. Hopefully you all noticed that this passage was a bit troubling, and using our normal yardsticks as Christians, it didn't seem to make sense. In past years, I've preached on Amos, or I've preached on something unrelated because of an event here in the town. But this year, I found myself facing the lectionary and the need to preach on this passage. Now, I'm not going to confess any kind of sin on my part here, but I also don't want you to think I'm being snarky when I say that this passage is a hot mess. And evangelical and mainline commentators whom I consulted in preparing this sermon, and remember, these are people who often have wildly different views of reality, all shared the same opinion, that this is a tough passage. Indeed, it is perhaps the most challenging parable in Luke. So if you're not satisfied with today's sermon, hopefully you'll cut me a little slack. You'll notice there was a parable at the beginning, and that would be essentially verses 1-9, and then there were interpretive glosses, and those were verses 10-13. And in a way, it seems like this passage is kind of random, sort of like my children's sermon was before. But if we look at it carefully, we'll see that it is going somewhere, and ultimately it is making a point. So just to recap the parable, we've got this rich guy who employs a steward. And the steward was the person who would take care of his estate and was responsible for managing things. And the steward squandered the rich man's wealth. Now, in chapter 15, which comes before today's passage, we have the parable of the prodigal son. And you remember what the prodigal son did with his father's wealth? He squandered it. So these two passages seem to share something in common. We've got a person who squanders wealth that was somebody else's and then realizes he's got a problem. But the similarities end there. Because in the parable of the prodigal son, we have a person who repents of his misdeeds and wants to make things right. And we have the authority figure who is delighted to forgive and to welcome his son back into the fold. That's not quite what happens here, is it? The steward suspects, and rightly, that he's going to be fired. And he hasn't a clue as to what he's going to do once he loses his job. He can't be a laborer because he's not strong enough. He doesn't want to beg because he's got too much pride. So what does he do? He comes up with a scheme to cheat his boss. And his hope is that the people he involves in this scheme, the people he's supposedly helping, will be implicated in what he did and will then take pity on him when everything comes to a head. So he tells one guy to shave a bill, another one to reduce his debts, and then the rich man finds out what has happened. Now, we're all good students of the Bible. And we know that the logical thing to happen here is for the rich guy to lay down the law with the steward, to tell him he's awful, to bring him up on charges, to seek justice. But that's not what happens here, is it? No. The rich man tells the steward, I like your scheme. I respect that. Now, what kind of lesson is that? Go out, cheat on your taxes. Commit fraud. Don't be fair with your customers. Do we think that's what Scripture actually wants to tell us? You're not saying anything. Maybe we wanted to say that, at least to let us cheat around the edges. But we know, looking at the gospel as a whole, that's not the message of Jesus. And that wasn't the message of God to the Israelites. Now, just as an aside, you know there are different ways to interpret Scripture, and some suggest that God dictated the Bible and every word is to be taken literally and there's no questioning allowed. And then there are those of us who suggest that maybe Scripture is divinely inspired, but it was still written down by human beings. And I think this passage is a good example of why we should believe that Scripture was written down by human beings, because it could have used a little bit more editing. But we've got the Scripture we've got the canon we've got, and we have to work with it. Jesus tells us about the children of this age and the children of light. And here, if you look at the sermon title, you'll see it means, surely you mean someone else, right? We don't want to think that we're the children of this age. We want to think that we're the children of light. Because the children of light are good, and the children of this age are bad. But guess what? Even if we are the children of light, we still have something to learn from the children of this age. We still need to deploy all of our faculties, all of our cleverness, all of our thoughtfulness to share the gospel. Now, it's a temptation in some churches, and I don't think so much in this church, but in some churches, to not want to deal with money, because money is dirty. Money is bad. So, in some congregations, the church doesn't manage the resources it has all that well. Or perhaps they're fortunate to have an endowment and they spend it all on themselves. Or they've got staff and they decide we don't need to pay them well. We don't need to pay them a living wage because they're doing the Lord's work and that should be satisfactory enough. But guess what? That kind of behavior gets out into the community. And what do people say about the church? That the priorities are wrong, that they're not fair to people. And who's going to want to come? Or we'll say, well, we don't need to do anything on social media. We don't need to deal with technology. That's not an option. We need to use that tool, just as we have to use telephones. And I'm sure that a few decades ago, there were people who didn't want to deal with telephones. We're entrusted with the gospel. We're entrusted with the church. And the church and the gospel are like any asset. If you don't take care of it, sooner or later, it is going to wither and it is going to die. The rich man in this story is indeed God, and the steward is Israel. And God is telling his people, and he's telling us, that we need to shape up, that we need to get serious about what we're doing, that it's fine for us to continue to do things the old way if they work, but if they don't, we need to try new things. We heard that we should take our ill-gotten gains and we should spend them so that we can have a home in eternal homes. Did any of you wonder about that when Brandon read that passage? Did that sound a little strange? Well, the Greek that is used in the text is not the word for homes. It's skenos, which is the word for tents or tabernacles. So the oxymoron there becomes so much clearer to us. Fine, worry about making money. Then go try to get yourself some security in a tent. Tents aren't permanent. Tents are going to fold. And Jesus here is warning against a false sense of security that we can place in money and wealth. I don't think I need to say too much about trusting someone with a little before we trust them with a lot. But that's one of those truisms we actually need to hear every once in a while. Think about your jobs. You are first entrusted with small tasks before larger tasks. And we are being trusted by God, and we need to continue to earn his trust. Which leads us to the payoff statement in this passage, which I'm sure you all recognized. You cannot worship God or mammon. Or I should say God and mammon. You've got to make a choice. Now, most of the people who followed Jesus around were poor. Most people in Jesus' day were poor. But there were some rich people who were attracted to his message. And this passage was directed at them, but it was also directed at the larger crowd. It is so easy for us to become a slave to our things and to our retirement accounts and to our money. To think, if only I had a little bit more, everything would be okay. But the truth is, if we get the little bit more, we want a little bit more. And a little bit more. And if we look at our society, we know who we're worshiping. My newspaper this morning did not have a God section, but it did have a business section. And I can get updates on the Dow Jones Industrial Average by the second. And I can hear about interest rates or inverted yield curves. But not so much about God. Our society is worshiping money. We have to make our own individual choice about whether we're going to join in. Now, I could use this as the intro to a stewardship sermon, but I'm not going to do that. But you are going to hear about money the next few weeks, because Luke is really interested in it, and particularly how we make use of what we've got and how we take care of the poor. they are our brothers and sisters. Who is they? Well, we know that's everybody, isn't it? So perhaps this passage isn't as confounding and as confusing as I made it out to be at the beginning. Maybe we were being led to this point about this fundamental choice we need to make in our lives. And we shouldn't just look at the 1% and say, oh, well, you know, I'm not going to be in a situation where I have to decide between a yacht or a helicopter, so Jesus isn't talking to me. He's talking to all of us. We've all been given resources. We've all been given talents. We've all been given skills. And we need to use them in the service of God. We should never find ourselves in the situation of the dishonest steward. Ever. We should find ourselves in a situation where the rich man, the master God, looks at us individually and collectively and says, not, gee, your scheming is pretty impressive, but well done, my good and faithful servant.